I'm Nish Weiseth.
I'm Amy Sullivan, and this is Impolite Company, a show where we talk about the tricky subjects polite people are supposed to avoid, especially religion and politics. This week, we're bringing you our roundup of the midterm elections, with a special look at how voting behavior among religious Americans is and is not changing during the Trump era.
And then, with the U.S. Catholic bishops gathered for their annual meeting in Baltimore this week, we'll take a deep dive into the church's ongoing sex abuse crisis. We produce this podcast with the generous backing of individuals who support us every month. Every month! A special thanks to all the new sponsors who have joined us in the past month. And if you like what you hear and think these conversations are valuable, you too can become a sponsor of Impolite Company. Simply click the link in your player's episode description or visit patreon.com. That's patreon.com/impolitecompanypodcast to sign up. Pretty easy.
So we are going to jump straight into our discussion of the midterm results. No long lead up necessary, especially since the midterms were a week ago now. Thank you for your patience, listeners. Sometimes life intervenes. It's actually kind of useful that it has been a week because as many people who maybe were following the news on election night know, it seemed a bit more of a toss up in terms of what the narrative was coming out of the midterm elections on November 6th versus now, where a number of high profile races have been resolved in favor of the Democratic candidate. So whereas people were talking about a blue ripple coming out of the elections the day after or a couple days after, now it does seem, with Democrats taking the House and capturing a few more Senate seats, so that I think the net pickup for Republicans was just one seat in the Senate, that this is a pretty good year for Democrats. That's what people assumed, since approval ratings for Trump are pretty low. And this was a very nationalized election. But looking around the country, we are a very divided nation. And I just wanted to run through some of the results that we saw, because certainly after 2008 and 2016, you heard people either saying, this is the country that we are. This is the one I recognize, or this isn't who we are. I can't reconcile what I'm seeing with the country I know. And the reality is that they are both pieces of the country that we are. They're two halves. So this is who America is. Two women become the first Muslim women in Congress, and Duncan Hunter wins re-election for his House race with a virulently Islamophobic campaign. Both of those are America. Colorado Baker last year won the right to refuse service to gay customers. And on November 6th, Colorado elected the nation's first openly gay governor. Although somebody reminded me, Oregon now has an openly bisexual governor.
Yes, Kate Brown.
So there are now two openly gay governors in the U.S. Two Democrats, and I think now one Republican as well, became the first Native Americans elected to Congress this year, at the same time that North Dakota's voter ID law suppressed thousands of Native American votes, and it was written in order to have that result. Parkland and the rest of Florida, now pending recounts, has NRA-approved governor and both senators. And at the same time, a gun control advocate, Lucy McBath, who is amazing and one of the main figures in the documentary Armor of Light that I have recommended before and you should all watch, she not only won the district that Democrats lost narrowly in the open race where John Ossoff ran last year, but it's the district that was held by Newt Gingrich.
Right.
So not a place where traditionally you could just waltz in as a gun control advocate and have that be what you're most known for and win. This is also who America is. in Georgia, Kansas, and other states, we saw elected officials closing or moving polling places in order to make it harder for people of color to vote. We also saw women of color win key House races all across the country. And at the same time that white women flipped all of the top positions in Michigan, my home state, I was pretty excited. Come January, there will be no white men holding any of the most important statewide positions in Michigan, plus two key House states that got House seats that got flipped by white women. White women nationally overwhelmingly voted for Ted Cruz, DeSantis in Florida, Kemp in Georgia. Those races were either won or are as close as they are in the recounts, because in some cases, white women voted even more than white men did for the pretty extreme Republican candidate. All of those things are what make up America, and it makes this a challenge. But I think it's more useful to be able to recognize that truth and proceed from there than to pretend when an election results in outcomes we don't like that that's somehow not America.
Yeah. The other one that I wanted to highlight as well, along with that long and exhaustive list that you just went through, was Florida, which is still openly being contested in two different races, both for Senate and governor, voted not shockingly, but wonderfully in favor of reinstating the voting rights to nonviolent felons who had served their time. And yet they did not currently, as it stands, vote for the candidate who actually supported that legislation. It's just, there are so many things that are in contrast to one another. And it just proves the point of two opposing things can be true at the same time. And it makes it really complicated. It makes it really hard to look at the data and look at all of these things that are coming out of the midterms about who voted for who and why and all of that, and have it make any sort of sense. It is really, really difficult to kind of apply intent, I guess, on these things when both of those things can be true at the same time. So it made the midterms really exciting for those of us who like to look at data, like Amy and I, we like to nerd out over that stuff. But it also makes it really confusing as far as like, okay, what does this mean more broadly for our country? And what are the different approaches that, particularly for us who are more liberal, like what are the different approaches that we can take on the left to try to capture more folks who are kind of in the middle, I guess, and who are wrestling through some of these things, just like a lot of folks are. So, yeah, really, really fascinating that, you know, so many things that seem totally opposed to one another can be true.
Nish may not know this yet, because in the year and change that we've been friends, I have not yet had huge reams of paper with polling data on them, but I love to dive into polling data. And over the weekend, I was at a gathering of journalists where we heard from a Pew pollster who went through as much of the exit data as he could find and compared it as well to the most current Pew surveys on religion and voting and religion and political attitudes. And I was joking with him that I viewed his presentation as a personal attack because
it is, damn it.
Well, he framed it in terms of going through some myths about the electorate, as he called them. And I thought, well, that makes sense, until I looked at all the myths. And they were all basically things that I try to argue occasionally. Things like younger evangelicals are more liberal and may, in fact, be turning to Democrats. In fact, not the case. We've got another one here. Quote, real evangelicals and Catholics are less supportive of Trump than our self-identified evangelicals and Catholics who rarely go to church. So here, the idea that people are adopting evangelical as a political label This is my idea of Fox evangelicals, you know, people for whom it basically is an identifier of a tribe rather than, or a political subset rather than actually a descriptor of their religious faith and practice. Also, apparently not finding that anywhere in the data. And to my question, which I've raised, I think, a couple times in the past year on the podcast of, well, maybe it is that the evangelical label is becoming kind of poisonous. And so what you find when you poll people and you get the results of white evangelicals is just a much more pure, boiled down to its essence, cohort of evangelicals than you would have in the past. No, apparently not a lot of evidence for that either.
Batting zero, like, here. Oh.
What is going on? So I finally raised my hand and was like, what about the gender gap? Is there anything there? And in fact, yes, there is a gender gap among white evangelicals, but there's a gender gap all over.
Right.
There's a gender gap among white Catholics. So now I need to sit down and crunch the numbers and find out if there is a significant difference in the size of the gender gap for white evangelicals versus some of these other religious groups. And it may be that one of the figures we've quoted earlier, that there is a perceivable significant gap among white college-educated evangelicals. It may be that that's the kind of the substratum you need to get down to actually see anything. But my conclusion on this, because I'm always happy to turn around and find a way that I am actually right, is that
true to form.
Well, actually, this makes a lot of sense.
Did you just well, actually?
I did.
That was so perfectly timed. You couldn't have played it better. That was amazing. Please continue.
Because I'm not sure that you would expect to see much change in an election cycle during which Democrats did little to no outreach focused on evangelicals. It's not like the party tried to see this as a group where they could pick off voters, nor has there been any organized effort among evangelicals themselves. You know, occasionally there are Twitter threads from people like Rachel Held Evans, yours truly, Nish, trying to argue that the case for evangelicals to consider breaking with their lifelong attachment to the Republican Party. But it is not as if there is an on the ground effort to make that case either in particular races or regions or nationwide. So the reporting we've seen so far, including the great New York Times articles over the past month, has been largely anecdotal. The stories you and I know about are also anecdotal. And I think that's because that's what's happening right now. It's individuals one at a time kind of coming to conclusions on their own. But we wouldn't expect to see any sort of movement because nobody's trying to start a movement.
Yeah, no one's trying to start a movement. And the other thing that we have to be mindful of, particularly with the evangelical voting bloc, is there's so much of it that really is rooted in fear. Let me say this. A lot of the conversations that I have amongst people that still identify as evangelicals and are voting Democrat are happening in hushed conversations over coffee in coffee shops. They're happening, you know, over kitchen tables, over dinner in individual homes. Like it's not happening widespread because I think that there is a fear that there would be not necessarily retaliation, but that there's consequences for holding those positions within an evangelical community, as we have seen both personally and anecdotally with a lot of our friends. As soon as they say, like, oh yeah, I voted for Hillary or I voted for so-and-so, it's almost like an immediate shunning. It's an immediate questioning of their orthodoxy and questioning of their faithfulness. There's the marriage between evangelicalism and republicanism is so tied and so tight that it would be really hard, I think, for evangelicals more broadly in a more communal context to have some of these conversations as a whole. So I do think that there may be, you know, just some general fear there as well.
I'm really glad you brought that up.
Yeah, it's, I mean, I know just from experience.
Because there are stakes here, and I think it's easy, it's really easy, and I still hold a whole lot of white evangelicals accountable here, but it's easy to say, you know, oh, you people, why can't you just, you know, stop it, look at Trump and see how dangerous he is, and just, you know, what's the big deal? Just switch sides. But you and I personally know people, and it's worth a reminder, who have lost churches over this, who have lost, gotten their books taken out of bookstores, who have lost speaking gigs, who have lost marriages in some cases. You know, there are very high stakes in this community. And it's not simple. It's going to be a long process. And it helps when you know you're not alone. But so far, the movement has been very quiet and in such small numbers that I don't think if I were on the ground in this position, I would see a critical mass there to, you know, buffer me or support me.
Yeah. I mean, I was at a conference a couple of weeks ago. I think I talked about this on the last podcast, but I spoke at a conference called Evolving Faith in North Carolina, hosted by friends of the podcast, Rachel Held Evans and Sarah Bessie. And I specifically spoke about religion and politics and what it means to kind of disentangle your faith from that kind of tight marriage between evangelicalism and republicanism. And talked about it on, you know, like a more specific, on some more specific terms, but essentially like I started out my talk by saying like, hey, listen, I'm a like Bible reading, spirit filled, like, you know, like person who, you know, takes Jesus Christ very seriously. And I voted for Hillary Clinton. And some of the things that I addressed in that auditorium of 1500 people, things like making sure that people have equal access to healthcare, making sure that we have education reform that benefits every child and not just my child. Those things got, I mean, I'm not tooting my own horn at all. I just spoke the truth. And Amy, it got multiple standing ovations. And in a room of 1500 people who either are currently coming out of evangelicalism, are still in evangelicalism at some level and are kind of disenchanted with its marriage to republicanism, or have left it altogether. So and this is just a small microcosm of kind of a broader movement, I think, that's happening within evangelicalism as a whole. But to know just kind of firsthand and to see it with my own eyes that some of these really basic, like intro level democratic policies, like, you know, equal access to healthcare, like that is a classic democratic policy that's never going to change, got widespread enthusiasm. Is like, no, there's space here. And I think that there is opportunity here that's not being capitalized on, specifically in this voting block. And that audience was overwhelmingly white. It was an overwhelmingly white audience. And so I do think that there is space. I do think that there is opportunity. But again, like we haven't seen, especially in a midterm election, you're not going to see Democrats or the party itself kind of reach out to that voting block at all, which we didn't see this time. And unless they start making some moves now, I don't necessarily know how far they're going to get in 2020 either. So we'll see.
Not very, I would say, because it definitely helps to ask someone for your vote. That's kind of the most basic political wisdom.
Right.
Is if you want someone's vote, you need to ask for it. And
that's right.
That doesn't happen very much.
And don't patronize them. You know what I mean? Like, don't be weird about it. Just be genuine and honest. You'd be surprised at how, you know, widespread and welcoming a lot of faith communities would be to kind of, you know, classic democratic policies. But you got to ask. But no one wants to ask, Amy.
Well, and on the other side, I can't let us leave this topic without bringing up an argument that I know makes you red in the face as much as it does me. You don't want to jump straight from one marriage between religious and political allies to another in which you are taken for granted or beholden to one particular party. And I agree, in a perfect world, that is absolutely right, that both parties should have to compete for all votes, not just religious votes. But you also don't ever want to be in the position of being taken for granted so that your voice is diminished or rendered silent. However,
we don't live in a perfect world.
Yes. Thank you. I knew you were waiting.
I'm biting my tongue.
And it is just bonkers to pretend that that sort of like thoughtful approach can be applied to right now, especially when in the closing weeks of the midterm campaigns, we saw just disgusting, racist, fear-driven scaremongering from the president and from a lot of candidates in the Republican Party.
Yep.
And very few people, if any, on one side who were willing to call it out.
Yep.
And some people made an argument that if you don't take an action to show that that is not okay, then you are complicit in supporting it, basically. This is the same thing people didn't want to hear of, you know, I voted for Trump, but I'm not racist. I'm not approving of that. Well, then I hope you called your congressman and your senator every day in the last 2 years to let them know how much you hate those aspects of his policies, because if you didn't, then you do own that part of him.
That's
and
right.
That part of what he's using his power to enact in this country.
I would love it if we lived in a world where, in order to place a check on a tyrannical president's power, that people did not have to, in some ways, compromise closely held values. Like, I wish that that was a world that we lived in where there was space for that, right? I wish. However, that is a fantasy world. Like, that is not actual reality. I know that we want to talk about, and there is space to talk about, the pitfalls and downsides to our two-party system and blah, 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 and how each side is becoming more polarizing. Yes, I get it, 100%. However, it's reality. It's where we are right now. And so I think there is space to move ahead in those conversations, but we also have to face the very real problems that we are encountering right now. And the only way to place an adequate check on this administration that is doing reprehensible damage to communities of color, to immigrants, to religious minorities, to LGBTQ people, to women, the only way to do that is to put an opposing party in power. That's currently the system we have, and that is the system that we have to operate in at the moment. And this idea that, like, oh, well, you know, I don't want to vote for, you know, this other party because I don't want to, you know, marry to their ideology. And I'm like, no one is asking you to vote for Democrats in all perpetuity for all time. I am not asking you to change your party registration. Like, I am not asking you to do that. I'm simply saying we live in an exceptional time. We have a president who is breaking norms every single day, and something has to give. Like, we have to stop the bleeding, right? And so this complete unwillingness of people to live in reality is enraging to me. It makes me so mad because the stakes are so high. Not only are the stakes high, like what we talked about before, for, you know, evangelicals to walk away from that marriage. There are very real life consequences. There are also very heavy consequences for allowing the Trump administration's powers to go unchecked, specifically for those marginalized groups. And so we have to start voting and thinking in this exceptional time with our neighbors in mind and with those marginalized groups in mind. And you have to operate within the system that we have currently in order to make it work. It's just the reality. And I know it sucks. Yeah. And you're going to have to hold your nose and do it.
Zero patience.
Zero.
For people who love to do the pox on both of them line. And there are people who make whole careers out of that. But right now, there is only one party that has slid to the extreme end of its ideological spectrum that refuses to call out white nationalists within the party that ran an actual Nazi in Illinois this year.
Like saying the party Nazis
that brags about delivering tax cuts to billionaires and says, you know, we got to vote for this because otherwise they won't give us money. There's only one party that's a completely abandoned moral leadership. And that doesn't mean that you don't have problems with some things that Democrats do, but there's only one party that falls along those lines. And recognizing that is not the same thing as forming an alliance with the Democratic Party. It's called being a sentient human being.
If calling Nazis bad is too hard for a candidate... Like, I don't understand why that's not a deal breaker for literally every person on the planet. Like, how is this hard? How is this hard? It's not hard. It's not hard. But apparently it's just too much. Too much to ask for one election.
But abortion-ish.
Oh, don't. Nope.
So, yeah. Nope. That's another day. But that's the response I got most often when fighting this fight online.
But what aboutism? So fun. Okay, let's move on. We have another very serious topic.
Yes, we do. Because, every 2 years, the first 2 weeks in November are awfully busy for reporters who cover religion and politics. Because we usually have an election followed immediately by the annual meeting of the U.S. Catholic bishops in Baltimore. These things are usually pretty predictable affairs. Sometimes they elect different bishops to different leadership positions, but usually it's, you know, a handful of the same old topics that they like to discuss. However, this year, especially coming off of the Pennsylvania grand jury report this summer that just felt like a bomb on a lot of American Catholics. The Bishops' Conference was actually going to have some very serious debates about something that they haven't discussed in about 15 years, which is adopting new standards and best practices that would govern how church leaders must deal with reporting and disclosure and handling of allegations of sexual abuse. So important, so overdue, much of a small silver lining in all of this that there are church leaders now, Cardinal O'Malley among them, who are really pushing the conference beyond its traditional stance of denial to say, no, we do have to deal with this. And so they were ready to debate and adopt some measures that would then immediately go into effect. And one of the links that we will put up in show notes is a piece that a friend of the pod, Jack Jenkins, worked on for Religious News Service about a month ago, I think. He was looking at the various states where Catholic leaders are actually cooperating with state attorneys general. And it's, again, it's overdue, but it's really heartening that the church is actually turning over its books in so many different places to say, okay, enough of hiding our heads in the sand, hoping that this stuff will never come to light.
Wherever you focus a light on this stuff, you're going to find the same things as in the Pennsylvania grand jury report. It is not that Pennsylvania was a particularly bad area when it came to sex abuse and just shuttling around offenders from parish to parish. It was that now we know about it. And what the church knows with these collaborations between church leadership and attorneys general is that basically we are looking at a stretch of the next 2, 3, 4, 5 years where every few months there's going to be another bombshell like this that's going to take over the news. And I've had people say, you know, would it have the same effect? Because this one seems to have really shaken up Catholics around the country. And it's true, it did. But you have to remember, in every single one of those places, it will hit anew the people who have made their homes there their whole lives, who grew up in those churches, who knew and maybe were baptized even by the priests whose names are going to be on those lists. And so, yes, it is going to have an impact, and it is going to be ongoing now, not just occasionally Boston and then a decade later Philadelphia and then, you know, 5, 6, 7 years later Pennsylvania. This is just going to keep on coming out. And the church, it can't stop that. I don't think it should stop that. The only hope they have of not completely losing the trust and faith of all lay Catholics in the U.S. is to show that they have gotten the message, that they have learned the lessons, that they hear the cries and the grief of American Catholics, and that they are doing something. So all that to say that they had draft proposals ready to go and be debated and voted on. And then we learned on Monday morning that the Vatican had asked the bishops to not take any action. Oh, why would the Vatican do this? Well, the Pope had previously called a gathering, I think, of all the world's bishops, possibly just archbishops, but I think it's bigger than that, in January of this year, so just a few months away, to basically have a crisis meeting about sex abuse and how it is handled. And so the Vatican's argument is, hey, what's the rush? Just hold off until we can all talk about this. And that may seem like it makes sense, but it is so crushing to the victims, and it is completely tone deaf in its ability to understand how important this is and what a critical point the Catholic Church is at in the U.S. right now.
That's my question. Is it feels just so remarkably, at first glance, it just seems really tone deaf at like, do you not like, does Rome not really understand the depth and seriousness of what's happening in the United States regarding sex abuse within the Catholic Church? Like, that's my first question. Is like, do they just not understand because they're not here? Like, do they not understand the gravity of the situation, number one, but also the will of so many faithful Catholics who desperately want there to be action, who want there to be policies in place to protect people and to protect victims? Does Rome just simply not understand, or do they understand and want to do it on their own terms? Like, that's the question that I'm kind of sitting with, is what's happening here? Why in the world, on something so serious that demands, I mean, frankly, this is long overdue. Any sort of action is decades long overdue. Why in the world would you wait one more minute? Like, why would you pull the e-brake on something so important unless you just didn't understand, or you did and you want to do it on your own terms? Like, those are the only two reasons I can come up with. And both of them seem baffling to me. I just don't get it.
Sure. So as it happens, I have some context for this. I don't know if I have great answers, but at this same gathering where I got to be annoying to pollsters over the weekend, we were lucky enough to have John Allen, who is a Catholic journalist who's been covering the Vatican for decades. He's basically the Maggie Haberman of Catholic reporting in the U.S. Like, he gets people to talk to him. And so he attempted some answers at what's going on here. And it's important to note also that as he so often does on this stuff, and it is one of the few areas where I think Francis really does have a tin ear, I think when it comes to women in the church, and when it comes to recognizing the urgency, not that sex abuse is serious. I think he gets that. I think he does not understand the urgency of dealing with it, nor the optics when he either does what he did in Chile when he visited, I think it was last year, and basically berated the critics of the Chilean church who had covered up, who had in many cases been the abusers themselves. It was as off as he has been since he's been Pope. And it is really hard to understand that. And that was my top question, was what explains this? Because I cannot wrap my head around it. And so I want to just walk people through a few of the contextual explanations that I got. One is that, yes, it's an incredibly important topic, and especially in the U.S., if you look worldwide, it is not something that the majority of the church is dealing with, which is not to say that there aren't problems with clergy sex abuse in every corner of the world where the Catholic Church exists, because there's child sex abuse everywhere in the world, regardless of whether it's inside the Catholic Church or out. But there's a difference between places where they recognize it and places where they have not had it investigated by outside journalists, say, or have public protests from lay Catholics themselves. And places like the US or Ireland or Chile now, or Belgium or Germany, or there are places, but mostly in the Western world, where this has come to light and where the time is now to deal with it. And so one of the things John Allen raised was the example of, you know, there are a lot of Catholics, more Catholics, many more now in the developing world than there are in the traditional kind of Western European world. And if you are, say, the bishop or archbishop in Lahore, Pakistan right now, your biggest concern is censorship laws, which threaten to put to death Catholics who talk about their faith, where there's a woman who just for the first time had her conviction overturned. She'd been in prison for 7 years, and now the vast majority of Pakistanis who are polled on this say that they would themselves support her being put to death now that she's on her own. And so we're hoping she's out of the country because her life is not safe. You know, we talk a lot about religious freedom. That is an example of really severe concerns about religious freedom. That, you know, when you are the head of a global church, is also on your plate. He raised the fact that in Argentina, where Francis is from, certainly they've had problems with sex abuse. Again, it hasn't been a crisis. And he defined the crisis as a kind of crisis that is externally imposed upon the church because there's an investigation and there are protests. And it comes to light that Catholic leaders have been moving people around. And he also raised the fact that the Vatican, for all that Francis is the first Pope from outside Europe, is still a very, very, very Italian institution. And he also pointed out that there's been no crisis or scandal around this in Italy. And in fact, they are so blind to how dangerous this can be for the church in terms of losing members and losing the trust and faith of Catholics, that he told this anecdote that I want to repeat because it takes a lot to just kind of flatfoot me when it comes to Catholics and the sex abuse stuff. But he told the story of, I believe it was the Archbishop of Milan, who was deposed in a sex abuse case. And this indicates how like nonplussed they are by these issues. He was asked things like, you know, did you know about the charges against this priest? And he was like, yeah. And asked, okay, knowing of those charges, did you approve his transfer to this other parish? And he says, well, of course I did. Okay, well, were you aware that in his new capacity, in this new parish, he was going to be in charge of youth ministry? And the archbishop says, yeah, of course I knew. It's, you cannot conceive of an American Catholic leader saying those things. I mean, it would be very squirrely, like, you know, I can't recall, and it's been a while, I'm not sure I saw those papers. He didn't see any problem in, like, yeah, what's the big deal? And I think it recognizes both the rot that is still within the church in terms of dealing with these things and prioritizing victims over your fellow father. But it also, I think, for me, was a wake-up call of, oh, they really don't get how much of a problem this is. So I think all of that kind of combines to give you leadership in Rome, whether it's the Pope or the people around him, who lack an appreciation for the urgency and for the survival of the church, really. I mean, we've talked about Ireland before, but what is to stop the U.S. from going the way of Ireland? I'm not sure there is much, especially not if we're looking at, you know, 5 years of scandal after scandal after scandal after scandal.
Right, right. So now that Rome has said, you know, hold up, pull the e-brake, don't do anything yet, what has been the response of some of the bishops? What's the way forward here? What are people saying? What is, I mean, because in just in the very limited amount that I know, it seems like once Rome speaks, that's it.
No, not necessarily. So what's been surprising, and I've been watching some of our colleagues who are in Baltimore covering this stuff this week, who are, you know, they're seasoned to this stuff. And so when they are shocked, it means something different is going on. And so you are seeing bishops and cardinals rise to the microphone and say, yeah, the Vatican is completely out of touch here. They do not understand what is going on. Cardinal Subic has proposed that they at least take a non-binding vote so that American Catholics can see they want to do something about this. And this is what they would do if their hands were untied by the Vatican. As he has in the past, Francis has belatedly, but at least realized, whoa, I really kind of stuck my foot in it. So what was announced Tuesday morning was that he had appointed a man whose name escapes me, but who is a Catholic leader in Malta, who has basically been his envoy in the past. He's the one who dealt with the case of, I want to say it was a Mexican cleric who was just a notorious child predator, just awful stuff. And investigated and dealt with that. He was the one who got sent to Chile after the Pope just completely muffed up things and did his own investigation in an extremely thorough report back to Francis and resulted in Francis canning all of the bishops in Chile, just in one fell swoop. And so he has been tasked to deal with the issue now, and specifically to investigate what went on with Cardinal McCarrick, because that is the one that seems to have outraged people most inside the church and inside church leadership, as well as parishioners, is the idea not just that this guy wasn't caught, but that people knew about it and he kept getting promoted up and up and up. And here, what's extremely controversial about it is that it probably finds its way back to its roots during John Paul II's papacy. And because people were so eager to canonize him, he is now Saint John Paul II, which will be extremely awkward if an investigation finds that either he personally or close advisors to him during his papacy knew about this. Yeah. So we've got some really tough days ahead for American Catholics. We'll wrap up the show with our praise and petition segment, in which we shout out the things that are bringing us joy and call out the people and situations who are making us cranky. Nish, what's going on with you this week?
Well, you have to know, I mean, certainly you must know that I can't let this opportunity pass by without mentioning that Game of Thrones has a start date, or at least a starting month. It's coming back in April.
Is that good or is that making us cranky? Because April.
It is April, but you know what? Past seasons of Game of Thrones have premiered in the fall as well, like, or at the end of summer. And so I'm like, you know what? I know, like, 2019 is probably going to be a long year. And so I'll take April. I will take April All over right. August, you know?
You're being nicer than I am.
It is what it is. And I am taking solace in knowing that every episode is going to be well over an hour long. It's going to be so good. Can't wait. I've been watching all the little like preview teaser things that they're doing.
They're preview teasers.
Well, they're not like teasers of new footage, but it's just kind of like reminding you of like all of the different storylines that are at stake.
Right? It has like, been a long time. So we may need to completely rewatch the last season.
I am probably going to do that. And I have some theories about how I think it's going to end.
La, 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 la. I don't want to hear them.
I know. I have what I really want, what I deeply, deeply desire. But because it's Game of Thrones, I hold that very loosely. And realize that that's probably not going to happen. So I am going like, you know, full, like worst case scenario. That's what's going to happen. That is what that's my theory, is that it's worst case scenario. But I am really excited. I'm super excited. I cannot wait. Spring TV is going to be epic. So that is what that is what is on my mind, because there's really nothing else I've been paying too much attention to this week. I had two sick kids. Well, I had a sick kid with strep and river trips and just, you know, life. So I was happy to get that news. What about you? What you got going on?
Well, being in Miami made me happy. Normally, I don't set foot in Florida. I do not trust the alligators. I do not trust the sharks. I do not trust the zombie people who eat people's faces off, which happens in Florida.
It does.
Or at least has happened.
But I trust
more than once.
I trust pina coladas in South Beach. That's what I trust.
Yes. So I spent a few days in the sun and did not melt. And for me,
I
wouldn't get burned.
Wow.
So that is quite an accomplishment. Well, when you're at a conference, you are spending most of the time in a ballroom. But anyway, that was a very good thing. Also, I introduced my children to The Sound of Music and they actually sat through it with me. Yes.
That's a long movie too.
It is. Well, we did it in three installments, but they were like begging to get back to it, which is exactly what I wanted.
That's awesome.
They did not let me sing along, which I have to work on them for the next time, because we have now purchased it on our DVR or whatever.
Yeah.
And there is a sing along version. So, we are going to be doing the sing along. That is half the fun of it.
Absolutely. No brainer.
But here was one of Finney's observations that get ready for this to blow your mind.
Okay.
Every time Christopher Plummer came on the screen when she was first introduced to Captain Von Trapp, Finney was like, he looks really familiar. Who does he look like? And I knew, knowing her, she's thinking of somebody in the Harry Potter universe.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
So the next time he came on, I was looking and was like, Lucius Malfoy. He is totally a young Christopher Plummer, is a dead ringer for Jason Isaacs. Or Jason Isaacs is a dead ringer for young Christopher Plummer. Check it out.
Okay, I'm Googling that.
You will have your mind blown.
Oh my gosh.
So that was kind of surprising.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and I think that's it, except that we are, preparing for a certain little boy's fifth birthday.
Big deal.
This weekend. And he is going to have a rainbow and unicorns party. And
I can't wait. I love that kid. We have a birthday
here, PJ.
Too.
Everybody is PJs. Instructed that they have to show up in PJs.
Heck yeah, PJ parties.
Yeah.
I love
it. Tried to get him to narrow down to like four or five themes for one party. It's been a struggle.
So cute. Like,
and they have to be Paw Patrol PJs.
Obviously.
Let's not put that on the invitation, buddy.
It's so cute. Oh my gosh, I love that kid. The best. We're celebrating a birthday here too this week. Rowan turns 9.
Oh, Rowan. Almost double digits.
Almost double digits. We're almost there. So we're going to have some cake and ice cream with the neighbors and no themes, no big celebration. That's not Rowan's style. So we're just doing cake and ice cream and pizza with the neighbors. And then we're going to head to the big city and do the indoor trampoline park. So that's what we're doing this weekend. So yay for birthdays for our little guys.
Yay.
So fun. Awesome. All right. Well, that is all for this week's episode. Thank you so much for joining us. Impolite Company is produced every week by Constantine Hios. If you've enjoyed our conversation, please, please rate us on iTunes. It's the very best way to let other people know about us. And if you'd like to support the show, check out our Patreon page and consider supporting us financially so we can continue to expand the conversation. Until next week, have fun storming the castle, kids.